today. I think we'll start at the bottom of the agenda and bring up a work session on House Bill 2625 first this morning. I'll open a work session on House Bill 2625. Who do we have on that? Sorry. Is that Lizbeth?
No.
Mazin. Oh, Mazin. Okay. Sorry, I should have mentioned that before we get started. Then that way we can deal with these Treasury bills and education bills together after that. Good morning. John Phillips, did you get some answers on, you want to come on up and tell us about that while we're waiting for Elizabeth?
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. I did look into this a little bit, talked to several people in various counties about the cargo container questions, and I emailed a memo to you last night and to Mazin this morning, but I'll read it here briefly. Questions regarding cargo containers. Would you rather have Mazin go first, or you want me to continue?
Go ahead. You're here. Mazin can distribute your memo.
Questions were regarding whether containers were taxed by, let's see. Excuse me. By rail or by tractor trailer or on inland waterways, and my conclusions were that they were all taxed the same for various purposes, so no real difference. Not a big outstanding conclusion, but definition is standard throughout the state, and this bill would just simply exempt domestic trade cargo containers.
And again, my recollection from the testimony was that this bill reinstates an exemption that was on the books since the 70s.
Yes, 1979.
Yeah, 1979. Okay.
There was another question about why the 79 legislation went back to 74, and I was not able to turn that over.
All right. Mazin, do you have anything to add? Any amendments? We don't have any amendments.
No amendments, Mr. Chair, but I have to say that this was the first time I'm not here in time, and you started with my bill from the bottom.
Sorry. I torpedoed you. You're winded, Mazin.
Yeah.
Do you need to go out and pick anybody up out in the hall? All right. Are there any questions from committee members? I think there was a... Okay, thank you, John. I think there was a fair consensus on this bill when you heard it the last time. And if there are no questions, Chair would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
I move House Bill 2625 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Scott moves House Bill 2625 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay. There are none. Please call the roll.
Representative Burger.
Aye.
Carr.
Aye.
Pass.
Aye.
Austin.
Aye.
Scott.
Aye.
Berger.
Aye.
Chair
Shatterly. Aye. House Bill 2625 goes to the floor with a due pass. Do we have a carrier? Representative Berger. Close the work session on House Bill 2625. Let's go to 2664, kind of working our way from the bottom up. Thank you, Mazin. Steve, the rest of them are yours, right? The top two are, who has 2663? Is that Lizbeth?
Lizbeth.
Yeah. Oh, never mind, Lizbeth. We'll do 18 and 2663 then. Stay where you are. There's probably $900 already. Oh, bad staff management this morning. Sorry. Okay, let's take up HJR 18. Steve, if you could bring us up to date.
committee, Mr. Chair, members, House Bill or House Joint Resolution 18 is a constitutional amendment that would authorize the state to issue general obligation bonds up to one half of 1% of the real market value of the state. And it would require that these bond proceeds be used to match general obligation bonds raised by school districts for pre-K through grade 12 capital costs. And it defines capital costs as the acquisition, construction, improvement, remodeling, maintenance, or repair of public schools. And that it requires that the bonds be repaid from funds set aside by the Legislative Assembly from the general fund or other funds. And it specifically prohibits the repayment of the bonds from property taxes, either state or local property taxes. And then it has various implementing legislation provisions. And it requires that the measure be submitted to the voters at the May 2004 primary election. You had a dash one amendment offered at the public hearing, and I think you there's a dash two. I'm not sure if it's been handed out.
It has been handed out, yeah.
From the Fraser's office, I believe.
Okay. Who from Treasury wants to come up and talk to us about the dash two? From Treasury wants to go first.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Inga Deckert with the Oregon State Treasury. You have before you dash two amendments, both to HJR 18 and House Bill 2663. And I believe you also have a summary before you of those amendments, and I'll just walk us through those quickly. Essentially, the amendments make HJR 18 a constitutional revision as opposed to a constitutional amendment as it's originally written. This was at the suggestion of the chair. And the reason for this was, if you remember back to our first hearing, capital costs as used in the Constitution currently, when ballot measure 19 passed and it created the essentially the rainy day fund for schools, it converted the education endowment fund to the education stability fund. We created a school capital matching sub-account, and the purpose of that account was to provide grants to school districts, essentially the same purpose for which we are seeking to pass HJR 18. And in that, the term capital costs is given a more narrow definition than capital costs as defined in HJR 18. So by making this a constitutional revision, we can have capital costs mean the same in both sections of the Constitution. So it will essentially capital costs will be given the definition that is listed in HJR 18. The second amendment would remove the school capital matching sub-account from the Education Stability Fund, and it would place it in Article 11-0, which is the article that will be created upon passage of HJR 18. And the reason for this is that we thought it made the most sense to actually create the matching account in the article in which we're creating the bond program. So it would now all be housed in the same article in the Constitution. And we also are changing the name of the school capital matching sub-account to the school capital matching fund, since it's no longer a sub-account of a larger fund. It's its own fund within, or would be its own fund within Article 11-0. And the amendments also would allow the lottery money that will hopefully eventually pour into the sub-account. If you'll remember, when the rainy day fund for schools reaches 5% of the general fund and is capped at that amount, and lottery monies that had flowed into the rainy day, a portion of those then would be diverted and flow into the sub-account. This would allow those monies to be appropriated, allocated, or transferred to the school capital matching fund to pay debt service on bonds issued under the program that we are creating under HJR 18. That's one option. So we could either use those monies to distribute grants directly to school districts, or to pay debt service on bonds that we're authorizing within this HJR 18. And the thought behind that was if those lottery monies eventually do begin to flow into that account, it would be, one, quite some time probably before any monies did flow in, and two, once they started flowing in, it might not be that much money. It would take a long time to accumulate a fairly meaningful amount for schools, so to better leverage that, you could just use it to pay debt service. And the last amendments listed in your summary actually are just, there are some technical changes to both the HJR 18 and the House bill, and in the House bill, we're also deleting the $1 appropriations that were found in Sections 6 and 7. So I'd be happy to answer any questions on that.
So basically then what this does, it creates the authorization for the state to issue general obligation bonds to fund this capital matching fund. And then it coordinates the definition of that capital matching fund with the capital matching fund that's currently in HJR or the Education Stability Fund. So we just have one capital matching fund that would capture money both from the overflow of the Education Stability Fund and from any bonds that would ever be issued under the authority of HJR 18.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And that fund then would now be housed in Article 11-0, as opposed to in the Education Stability Fund.
And HJR 18 is just the authorization. It doesn't create any debt or issue any bonds itself.
Correct.
That would take subsequent legislation Okay. Who else? Either? Okay. Chuck, you know? All right. Questions for the panel?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm curious why. I understand what this revision does and how it makes sense, but why is it a good idea to essentially take away the function of creating the school capital matching fund from what I guess we still call the rainy day fund? I mean, I know it will build up slowly and can maybe not significant amounts that would be raised, but that was one of the selling points of the original plan when it grew.
Well, I'll venture a stab at that. My concern in looking at HJR 18 was that we would, if this is approved, you would have a capital matching account created under HJR 18, and you would have a separate capital matching account under the Education Stability Fund, and they would both essentially serving the same purpose, but they wouldn't be the same funds, and they would have mechanical and structural differences. So by putting this together, you're merging those capital funds, capital matching funds, into one. I don't know if it's necessarily taking it away from the Education Stability Fund. It's coordinating it with the debt authorization under HJR 18 so that the funds would flow into the single capital matching fund, and the state wouldn't be administering two different capital matching funds for school districts. That was my thinking. Did we accomplish that with the dash twos?
Well, Mr. Chair, then why not? I mean, that makes sense. So why not just eliminate that fund? Program, that concept of after you get up to 5 years or 5%, why even have that function?
You mean under the Education Stability Fund?
Okay.
I guess that gets into, in my thinking, that gets into more fundamental amendments to the Stability Fund, because that ties into the 5% cap that was part of the Stability Fund.
Right. So really just for trying to find something else to do with that money after it gets to the cap, and because we don't want to be redundant is really what's happening here, right? Your explanation.
Something else to do with that money. It's still going to serve the same purpose as is currently provided in the Stability Fund. Inga, do you want to weigh in?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Pass, in making these amendments, we did leave intact the original intent of the creation of the subaccount within the stability fund. Essentially what we did was we just moved it over so we have it all in one article, and we left intact the funding of that and the purpose for which those funds could be used. So I think that the chair's description is accurate, that we've essentially consolidated what would have been two programs into one. We still have the same funding sources, i.e. the lottery revenue that could flow into this, still flowing in along with any other monies that the legislature should choose to put into that account.
Representative Williams is working on his statement of economic.
Thanks for pointing that out. I may have to have people from the Treasury help me with it because it's so vast.
Representative Berger.
Maybe I've missed this, but is there any place in the bill that says anything about the process of how those matching funds would be expended? In other words, is it based on need? Is it based on anybody that can come up with the local funds? How is that going to be prioritized?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vercher, in the House bill, we have laid out the basic parameters, and then the Department of Education could make rules to promulgate this program and to put this into place and distribute the grants. And the basic parameters are that a local school district would have to pass a bond measure for at least 50%, so at least half of the cost of the school facility, and then the state could match that local school district up to 30%.
So in other words, it really just relies on which school districts could pass the bond measure for the matching fund.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vercher, a school district would have to pass a local bond measure in order to be eligible to receive these matching funds.
Yes, I understand that, but in other words, that's really the floor. In other words, any school district that could pass that would then be eligible.
Correct.
We're both saying a little bit different things. You're saying they must do it. And my statement is that any school district who does do it, then that becomes the eligibility for that.
Then they would apply to the Department of Education to receive whatever percentage they could receive as a match.
And one more.
Yeah, sure.
And so the Department of Education then looks at need for new capital improvement or the disintegration of the building, or in other words, I'm at a loss as to how small rural schools like those in my district with declining enrollment fit into this picture. We don't always have trouble passing the bond measure. We have real strong support for our schools, but how are we going to play at the table in this particular process? And that's what I'm trying to get at.
Brian Reeder is here from the department, and maybe we could bring him up when this panel's done. He could talk about how the department might conceive of implementing the rules to do this.
Okay. That would be fine.
Yeah. Representative Scott.
Do I understand this correctly, that if these were to pass, that the bonding mechanism from the state would supply matching funds to do capital improvements, and how would that be repaid?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, we actually have left that open in the implementing law. Essentially, any funds that the legislature would like to appropriate for that purpose would be eligible.
But I guess if the legislature issues general obligation bonds to capitalize the capital matching fund, then we would have available, then you're talking about debt service. Is that either
yes.
a general fund or
yes.
lottery or whatever other funding mechanism, debt service mechanism would currently be available? That's right. Yeah, there would be debt service on the bond. Chuck, I mentioned general fund and lottery. Do we have any other sources that we're currently using to pay back general obligation bonds?
Mr. Chair, well, I guess, you know, we're going to pay the Oregon Health Science University bonds out of tobacco revenues, and those are general obligation bonds of the state. So.
Chair.
Yeah, Representative Fast.
One more step at this point. I think it's pretty simple. I'm just not asking it right. If this measure gets out and it's passed, but before the legislature school district trigger it, what happens when the stability fund gets to the 5% cap? What happens to money after that, outside of that cap?
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, that money, I believe it's 18% of the net proceeds of the lottery flow into the rainy day fund, and then I believe it would be 15% would flow into the school capital matching fund. House Bill 2663 provides implementing law for that, so with this you would have the ability then to be able to use those funds without House Bill 2663. There's no mechanism to be able to utilize those funds, so they would just sit in that account
until there's implementing legislation.
Okay. That's just what I told you.
Any other questions? Thank you. Let's bring up Brian Reeder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brian Reeder with the Department of Education. I believe the question from Representative Verger was, how will the department decide who gets the money? What are the criteria for making the matching grants? And currently, House Bill 2663 leaves that up to the department and the State Board of Education in the rulemaking process, so that the bill does not specify any criteria for making those grants. So that would have to be, those criteria would have to be established through the rulemaking process. There would be a number of ways to do it. One of the simplest would be simply to set a percentage match, and that any district who levied a bond levy would then get some set percentage matched by the state. Another approach, which the state of Washington currently uses, is to look at the need of the district based on their assessed value per student. Also, need would be based on the number of students, which they refer to as unhoused students. That doesn't mean they don't have a school to go to. What it means is that schools are overcrowded based on a criteria which they use, which I believe is square footage per student. If they have they set a goal, and if they've got overcrowding based on that, then that would indicate a higher need. So it would be some combination of ability to raise revenue and the need based on overcrowding, and also some in dealing with renovations of existing buildings, which may be more common among districts that are losing students. They don't need to build new schools, but they may need to either renovate existing schools or replace existing schools that are just worn out. Some criteria based on the condition of their school buildings.
Yeah, sure.
Trent, tell me, historically, has it always been that local districts take care of their own capital projects and the schools are funded as far as the classrooms and school books and so forth? Is that right? Or do you now have money that goes into capital projects?
Chair Federley, Representative Verger, historically in Oregon, as far back as I can remember, and I'm still quite young, let's keep that in mind, capital, the responsibility for raising capital for construction renovation has been solely at the local level. I think one exception we have right now are grants the state makes. We call them facility grants, and they are intended primarily to help districts buy things like desks and computers to equip a new school or equip a renovated school, but not to actually build it. So the building itself is still a sole responsibility of the local districts.
Yes.
Brent, maybe you'd like or could comment on this. Do you feel that the reasoning for this has been that the money that comes in from taxpayers needs to go into whether it's the equipment that goes into the school or teachers or the actual direct education of the student, and then the local community has some share in and responsibility or accountability in the education of their students by providing them with a building and a school building. Would you say that was an accurate?
Chair Federley, Representative Berger, I'm not quite sure the best way to characterize it. And without venturing into my own personal views too far here, I think what's behind this is primarily the fact that we have quite a large amount of deferred maintenance in our schools right now. Because of the diminished funding that we've seen since the passage of Measure 5, districts have tended to save money or redirect the money they do have away from building maintenance to keep it in the classroom. It's a fairly common phenomenon, and not just in Oregon, but everywhere. When funding in schools is tight, districts tend to cut back on their regular maintenance. Over time, that results in more rapid deterioration of the buildings. They need to be renovated or replaced earlier. And right now in Oregon, we have a lot of, just about every district in the state has unmet maintenance needs and unmet renovation needs. And I think this bill is a response to that. By kicking in state money, it would better help districts to upgrade their buildings and keep them in better condition. I would also say that with the passage of Measure 5, a relatively large share of Oregon's population now believes that the state is responsible for everything that goes on in the schools, and that it has become more difficult to pass bond levies simply because the voters think it's everything related to school is a state responsibility, so they should not need to pay any more.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Other questions for Brian?
Mr.
Representative Warner.
May I comment on the last question?
You may.
It seems to me there are at least a couple of additional factors beyond the ones that the witness mentioned. One of them is that because of the funding change in the state, many districts are moving to larger elementary schools and to larger classrooms. In the district that I'm most familiar with, in Eugene, for example, many of the classrooms are too small for the class sizes that are now needed to be taught because of the number of teachers we're able to hire. In addition, one other factor is that many of the schools were built around the time I started school, with an expected lifespan of 25 or 30 years. Well, you can look at me and you know that they're well past their expected lifespan in the area I come from. And that's not only true in Eugene, but it's also true in Portland and in a number of other places. So while what the witness says is absolutely correct, there are at least those two additional factors, and I'll bet you that in the other districts there are others I haven't thought of.
Somebody else down there had a hand up, I thought. Representative Harris.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't want to read too far into the novel here, but we're going to get to House Bill 2663.
Actually, not. I hadn't planned on it today. Okay. That's got a... Here's the game plan. Now you make me tell you the end of the story.
Yeah.
HGR 18 and 2663 both have subsequent referrals to Ways and Means. My hope was to be able to rescind the subsequent And I think we can't on 2663. That's got some program costs to the Department of Education, since it takes effect, it would take effect in this biennium. My hope was, as we gaveled the meeting, to be able to rescind the subsequent on 18 and really just deal with the referral today. And frankly, what we did last session, if you recall, this passed the House, I think, 50 votes or more, and it was just the referral. We deferred any action on the implementing legislation until a later session, but to deal with the authorization first in the referral. Paul tells me that, at least in his conversation this morning while we were getting started, Ways and Means is reluctant to rescind even the subsequent on 18 right now. So my inclination today is not to move either of these, but to have a conversation with Ways and Means before we go forward, but probably to leave 2663 on the table this session anyway. And if we can get 18 out, then it would be a matter of dealing with the implementing legislation and the rulemaking in the next session after the authorization has been granted, because I think we are not going to get the subsequent rescinded on 2663.
Okay.
So now to your question.
Well, if I recall from last session, one of the thornier parts about that implementing legislation was sort of a sliding formula.
Yeah.
And so that I don't see that in 2663. I guess my question was, what's the intention there, to set that up in rules, or is there going to be any slide? Is it just a matchup, or how will that formula work?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Haas, the bill does state that the state board will establish rules for administering the program. There haven't been any discussions so far about how the match would be determined, what the criteria would be, that those details would need to be worked out.
There's actually three tiers here. One is HJR 18, which is purely the constitutional authority, with no money attached, no implementing legislation, nothing to it. Then below that would be implementing legislation. We see a model of it in 2663, but if we leave that behind, that'd be for the next legislature to deal with. That would get to the legislation implementing it, and probably even, I'm thinking the third tier, 2663 contemplates it, but I think it would, in any case, then rulemaking authority for the department below that.
Right.
Some of those questions we wouldn't have answered at this point, and I think that's why my inclination is to focus just on the constitutional authorization to create this fund, and then leave it to the next legislative session to deal with the implementing legislation and the rulemaking all in one piece. Again, especially with the Ways and Means referral on this, I think it would be problematic to send both of these to Ways and Means, because I think they would both get tied up in the Department of Ed budget, and I don't want to complicate that any more than it's going to be.
Plus, Mr. Chair, we were getting tied up last session with that whole formula thing and tying us in knots,
before
messing with the cart and the horse.
Yeah,
still in the
barn. Right. So this session will be a matter, I think, if we're going to do anything, it'll be just a matter then of putting out the referral to create the constitutional authority for such a fund, and then depending on how voters respond to that, leave it to the next legislative session to actually create the implementing language based on the outcome of the election a year from now. But again, my inclination today is not to move even HJR 18, but having heard these amendments, to defer action until we can have a further conversation with Ways and Means and see if we can get the subsequent repealed even on 18. Okay? Thank you. Any other questions for Brian? Well, we're in work session, but we've heard some testimony. Anybody else here want to reflect to the committee on any comments on HJR 18 or what you've heard this morning? All right, let me close the work session then on HJR 18. Again, we'll not take action on this, and I won't even open a work session on 2663. So thank you, Steve. I think we're done.
Okay.
Lizbeth, you're here. And let's open a work session on House Bill 2664.
Commissioner Shetterly and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin-Lahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. So with House Bill 2664, you have a Dash 2 amendment. Now, this is designed to replace the Dash 1 amendment, so we won't worry about the Dash 1 anymore. But what this is doing is it allows unused contributions to the College Savings Network to be claimed as a deduction for four subsequent years after the initial $2,000 deduction amount. So again, this is allowing a carry forward for deductions. Does not allow any unused deductions to be carried forward if the taxpayer deducts less than the entire deduction amount allowed annually. So basically, it would, if you had more than, you could have at the maximum $10,000 deducted, $2,000 each year for 5 years. It applies to contributions made beginning tax year 2004. So originally the bill was beginning in tax year 2002. This extends it out to 2004. Then the carry forwards don't begin until 2005. It allows Oregonians to contribute to the college savings program up until either April 15th or the day on which the taxpayer files an income tax return, whichever date is earlier. It deletes then the reference to qualified tuition savings program and inserts college savings network. It also replaces Oregon Qualified Tuition Savings Board with Oregon 529 College Savings Board. And it deletes the requirement in law that a penalty has to be for a non-qualified withdrawal, the minimum amount necessary to satisfy the IRS requirements of Section 529. And then it also authorizes the Treasury Department to establish then, by rule, new penalties for unqualified withdrawals. And according to the Treasury Department, from a prior testimony, it was established that these new penalties would include all years in which the account got a deduction. If they made an unqualified withdrawal, then they would have to pay back all of that amount that they got as deductions. It takes effect 91 days after the end of the 2003 legislative session. So this did reduce the revenue impact quite a bit and extended it out to the future bienniums, primarily in the 03-05 biennium. There'd be a loss in the carry forwards of just $80,804, and penalties would be bringing in roughly $26,757 for a net then of $54,000. And that does grow in the 05-07 biennium, $643,065, and then the 07-09 biennium at $1.2
million.
You didn't have the revenue impact?
No. I don't think we do.
No.
No. You forgot to make copies on your way down here.
I probably did. Sure could have.
Can we get copies made while we ask Mike Parker to come up?
Yeah.
Did we have that?
Definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Michael Parker, Oregon State Treasury. Elizabeth did a good job of explaining, I think, what our amendments do. I think the biggest change is to the roll-forward tax deduction. We're trying to make sure that we make this as a minimal impact as possible. I think the biggest change on these amendments is that we cap it at a five-year period. So when you're making a contribution to the college savings program of, let's say, $10,000, that the max being carried forward would be for 5 years. So it would not extend out in the future forever. So it caps it at that five-year threshold. That keeps the revenue impact significantly reduced, I believe.
So if you make $10,000 in 1 year, you carry forward, well, it would be $2,000 a year.
Correct.
If that's assuming you don't make any other deductions.
That's correct. It
would
be
any other contributions.
It would be 5 years per contribution. So if you put in $10,000 every year, you know, you could carry it forward for the, each contribution is allowed for another 4 year carry forward.
Right.
I think it's important to note, Mr. Chair, however, that some folks in our plan are putting in $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 per year, so they would get that deduction regardless of whether it was a carry forward or not.
But the deduction is still limited to $2,000 per year, no matter how much they put in.
Correct.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Parker?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Hess.
I just wanted to announce that. Ryan Deckert and I had a town hall a month or two ago, and Michael Parker was the star who came in and did a PowerPoint, and it was billed as here's how the college savings plan works, and he was magnificent, had about 60 people, and it was just a great program. And so I wanted to thank him for that and to tell you that if he's available to drive to Coos Bay or wherever you might need him on a
windy, rainy night.
There you go.
And one thing that we did talk about, Michael, I think, over the last few weeks is I support this bill and all things to do with this, but sometimes I wonder that as this program gets complicated with carry-forward provisions and the almost necessary requirement that you have an accountant who does your taxes, that maybe we are catering to a level of income earner that misses some middle-class people who don't have the sophistication or just don't access this for the goal which it was intended, just to help kids get to college and afford that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pass, the Treasurer actually also shares that level of concern. What we've tried to do in the plan is make it as easy as possible for folks to participate. It's as little as $25 per month. We recently had a board meeting, a College Savings board meeting, where the board has really been pushing for us to do investor education. And that's going to be a big focus of our next 2 years, is to actually have some investor education so folks know exactly how the plan works. And so it's not, you don't need to, you know, have that level of an accountant to have the ability to participate. So we're going to take it upon ourselves to be doing investor education and using the College Savings Plan as a way to get folks more financially literate. So we do also share that concern, and we're going to keep it as very simple as possible. On the good side, our forms and everything needed to participate is very, very simple. It explains it very, very well. So we're trying to keep it at that really level where folks can grab a form, sign up. We have a 24-hour call center where folks can ask questions. So we are trying to keep it at that level.
I appreciate that. And, you know, at the forum, for example, the questions that you received from these people were pretty, you know, low-level, you know, how does it work kind of things. And so I just want to make sure that we don't get too advanced for that purpose.
And, Mr. Chair, President, I certainly appreciate your comments, and it was very nice to be in Beaverton at the Public Library, which is a great facility. So I'd be happy to, again, anytime you want to do it again, be happy to be there again.
Of course, the nice thing about the program is it's as simple as you want it to be, I guess. If you're just contributing $2,000 a year or less, which, you know, most of your lower and middle income earners probably are, then you're not wrapped up in any of these carry forwards or anything like that. So that only gets complicated if you want to boost your participation in it. I guess that's a good thing if you're able and want to do that, but other people who just limit themselves to the $2,000 or less and play by the simple rules, and they still get the benefit for every dollar they put in.
Correct.
And my experience has been, as a consumer of this, that what I think Strong has done a good job in administering this with information available on the internet and by telephone and by mail as well. This is one of these programs where we're able to do it contracting with a plan administrator and not setting up our own state program to do this. And they've been very accessible and I think consumer or investor friendly in the way they've administered the plan so far.
And Mr. Chair, if I can just comment on that. Strong, our program manager, has won many awards for their customer service, and they staff that line 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So they do have folks on the phone all the time to answer questions that participants may have.
Yeah, I agree. Strong does a great job. I wish they could pick stocks better.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
There isn't any truth, is there, Michael, to the rumor that you and Representative Hass were charging a $5 cover charge and a True Drink minimum of these programs, right?
Mr. Chair, it was not as far as you know. No.
Yeah.
Okay, other questions? Okay, you have the revenue impact that's before us, and I guess the question of the committee today, we've whittled this down to a $54,000 net revenue impact, and the question if that's within the comfort zone of the committee. This did have a subsequent to Ways and Means that has been rescinded, so we are cleared for takeoff if the committee is so inclined on this bill.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Williams.
I've moved the -2 amendments to House Bill 2664.
Representative Williams moves the -2 amendments to House Bill 2664. Is there any discussion on those? Any objection? Hearing none. So ordered. Representative Williams?
I move House Bill 2664.
Oh, yeah, right. We need the motion to include the rescission.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we rescind the referral to the Ways and Means Committee and move House Bill 2664 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, I think that'll work. Representative Williams moves that we rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means on House Bill 2664 and that House Bill 2664 be moved to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonner.
I have one more question.
Yeah.
I think the answer is clear, but I would help me to make sure I understand how this thing works.
That's fine.
If I could. You said that some people put $4,000 or $5,000 a year into the program, even though they only get a deduction for $2,000. Why would anybody do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, we've done a large job trying to have folks understand what it costs to go to college, and most folks understand that $2,000 a year probably isn't going to get it done, given the rising cost of college. We have college cost calculators. We do a lot of education to let folks know when their child is a certain age, what it's going to cost when their child reaches 18. So if a child is 8 or 9, $2,000 a year probably is not going to make it, given you might get 3, 4, 5, 6% return, we're hoping, over that time period. So they figure out what it's going to cost per year to invest, and that's what they put in.
And the earnings are tax-free, no matter how much. You only get the deduction for $2,000, but the earnings then are tax-free.
That's the answer I was looking for.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's the advantage over just putting it in a
vehicle. You don't get the deduction for that extra amount over $2,000, but your earnings then are tax-free.
Correct. All earnings are federally and state tax-free.
I see.
Yep.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Okay. That is assuming that you use the fund for
correct
qualified expenses, and if you don't, then
correct
we make up the money on the penalties because you violated the program.
That's exactly right, Mr. Chair.
So we keep everybody honest.
That's right.
Okay. Is there further discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Barr?
Aye.
Pass?
Aye.
Austin?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Williams?
Aye.
Chair Shetterly?
Aye. House Bill 2664 as amended goes to the floor then with the rescission of the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Anybody volunteer to carry this?
Sure.
Representative Vance?
Great.
Okay. Thank you very much. With that, we'll close the work session and committee. We are adjourned.
That was easy.